Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, at least here on the East Coast. On the West Coast, it would be afternoon. And that is where my guest tonight is. He is on the West Coast, and I am going to be dialing his number, and we're going to be talking to him shortly. His name is Eric Pierpoint, and many of you know him. He is an award-winning author as well as an actor. And it's ringing.
Hello?
Hello, Eric. This is Mac.
Hey, Mac. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm sitting here. I've got myself a Perrier Lime. I'm staring out the window in the canyon. My dog is here, and now I'm talking to you.
Oh, well, that sounds like you're having a good time.
Everything's good. Where are you calling from?
Okay, good. I'm calling from Ohio.
Okay.
The phone, yeah, when it comes up on your caller ID, it wouldn't say Ohio because I have to go into Blog Talk Radio stream, and then the stream actually calls you, and that call comes from New York. So.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Oh, I didn't have my glasses on anyway, so I just knew you were going to call at 5, so.
Right.
Ordinarily, I wouldn't even answer the phone. I would just wait and get messages because 90% is telemarketers, right?
Oh, yeah. I do the same thing unless I'm expecting a call. And then what's really bad, though, is when you're expecting a call and then somebody sneaks in then when you're – and it's not really like they know that you're expecting the call, but it just seems that way. Like, I wouldn't even answer it if I hadn't been expecting a call. So I know.
I have a television where – it's synced in, so I get to see who's calling me if I'm watching TV.
Oh.
Like it scrolls across the TV.
Mm. Yeah, I got that too if the TV's on, but I don't always have it on. So, yeah.
Well, I don't know.
I
don't know how half of
I'm
stuff
sorry.
Works these days, you know.
Oh. Well, I guess we might as well just jump right in.
Sure.
Now, I know you're an actor, obviously, and you're an award-winning author, but the first question that I wanted to ask you, which is pretty much my standard first question, when did you realize that you wanted to be an actor?
Well, my story is I didn't know anything in terms of whether I wanted to be an actor and going into that. I was kind of going through a liberal arts education at the University of Redlands in California. And I was, once in a while, I would sign up for a theater course. And then I would chicken out. But I was interested in it. I was a ball player. I was interested in other subjects. And then finally, when I was a senior, I took a course. And it just kind of hit me. I got into a couple of plays, went to class. We had a good teacher, a guy named Dr. Paul Little. And so I was influenced by some good people around me. And I remember one day after rehearsal, I was just on stage alone. And it felt like I belonged there. And it was a strange feeling. It sort of hit me that it was home, you know? And so I chickened out after that year because I think I only took one course. I loved it, but I got I had a very practical stepfather, Robert Pierpoint, who was a White House news correspondent, and he happened to be in town during the Nixon administration, and the Nixon White House was the West Coast White House was in San Clemente. So I went down. I was proudly telling him that I was graduating and becoming an actor. And he sat me down, and he poured himself a Jack Daniels, and he poured me a Jack Daniels, and he proceeded to talk me out of it. So he said, there's no way you should go into that profession. It's a horrible profession. You know, it's just, it's this, it's that. And he knew a lot about, you know, the business. So I didn't, you know, I stopped. I got, I got delayed. I put myself on pause. I tried to find straight work. The first thing I did was I took whatever money I had, which was $900 at the time, and I hitchhiked my way around Europe, which a lot of people did back in those days. And then I got back, and then I got a straight job. My straight job was for the National Park Service. I thought, well, it'd be kind of nice to go be a park ranger and ride horses and, you know, around in some national park. No, they stuck me giving in the Lincoln Memorial, giving guided tours in the night shift from 5 o'clock to midnight during the winter. And that was my, I guess that was the next step into showbiz, because I got to give public speeches about Abraham Lincoln, but only about three times, because nobody ever showed up during those hours.
Yeah, that would be a funny time to have that.
Yeah. but the story that goes from there is I was still working for the National Park Service, and they transferred me to an experimental arts division of the Park Service in an abandoned amusement park. And I did have a little bit of artistic, experience as a potter. But they also wanted me to do sort of a jack-of-all-trades thing, helping run a children's workshop called the Children's Experimental Workshop. And it was run by a really big-time artist now named Wendy Ross. And we were just, you know, in our 20s at the time. And so I kind of felt that was pretty good. They lost the funding. I then answered an ad to be a manager of a restaurant, an assistant manager, and they hired me. And for almost no money, they worked my butt off for 6 days a week. And I just started to feel like I needed to get back in the game. So Catholic University in Washington, D.C. had a really good drama department with very, excellent professors, and I looked at their program. I took a couple of courses, and I decided to enter an MFA program there. But I had to work full-time. So I was managing restaurants and working on my MFA part-time. It took 4.5 years to get through it. But I learned so much. You know, I took so many courses, did so many plays. I even traveled in a bus and truck theater tour, a company called National Players, for a year. And for very little money, I think we were paid $150 a week, out of which we had to pay for our hotel rooms and food, and drive the truck ourselves, set up the set. We'd go from town to town between the East Coast and, say, the Rockies. Sometimes they were one-night stands, sometimes two, but we just were on the road with three different plays. We did Richard III, The Miser, and Boys from Syracuse. And you learn, it was interesting because you really, really learned a lot about yourself in theater and adjusting your performances to the size of the theater. We played in front of, 3,000 people some days and about 12 people other days. It was quite an experience, a really, really good experience. And by the time I got off of that, I was in my late 20s and back finishing my last year of grad school and then trying to figure out what to do. I could go on and on.
Oh, no, I was just waiting for you to stop talking. I mean, you can go on as long, well, maybe not as long as you want, because if you want to go on for 2 hours, well, then no.
No, I just think if you have particular questions along the way, feel free to interrupt.
Oh, yeah, because that's actually what I do, but I don't interrupt somebody while they're talking, so I at least wait until somebody's done talking. But I was going to ask you it may have been a long time after, and it doesn't have anything to do with acting, but when was it that you decided you wanted to start writing children's books?
Oh, I had written, so I had written a few screenplays. A couple of them were optioned. I had used them as sample writing. I had written, my manager called and said, Hallmark Channel is looking for a Western. Do you think you can write a Western? I go, oh, my God, yes, I can write, you know. And then I went home and tried to think of something to write, you know. And I had developed a screenplay, and I delivered it through Starz Entertainment. And they were pretty high on it, and Hallmark was also high on it. And they, unfortunately, stopped doing their MOW, Movies of the Week. Mm-hmm. I'd done a few Hallmark movies before as an actor. But the option came back to me. And my manager, Marilyn Atlas, said, you should turn this into a young adult novel. And I said, that sounds like a lot of work, you know. And this was probably 10, 12 years ago, I guess, or I'm not sure exactly, but some time ago. I got to thinking about it because the original screenplay called Bitterroot was written from the point of view of a man in his 40s who was a Civil War vet. This takes place in the 1800s, you know, 1870s. And he ends up adopting some children on the Oregon Trail. He's lost his own family, and the kids are in trouble, and they end up surviving together through his help. And so when I got to thinking about the book, I thought, you know what? I'm going to write it from 12-year-old's point of view, Caleb O'Toole. And mm-hmm. I decided that, you know, how interesting would it be to be a 12-year-old trying to help his two sisters get from the middle of Kansas after a cholera epidemic with his parents dead all the way to get to a relative's in the Montana Territory. How would that happen? So I wrote a few chapters, and a literary agent read it from Full Circle Rep, Adriana Dominguez. And mm-hmm. she rejected it. And I thought, okay, I'm an actor. I'm used to rejection. Why? Can you tell me why? She says, well, when you're writing for children, you need to have certain things in mind. I go, okay, give me some direction. So she did. She gave me some really good notes. And I said, all right, I'll tell you what. I'm going to rewrite the first 50 pages. So I put my dog Joey in the car, and I decided to do a road trip. So we turned over a lot of rocks along what would have been the Oregon Trail. And it was so much fun. I mean, I got to see things that, and I was trying to put myself in the mind of, during the Western migration and pioneers. And I have a really thick history, pioneer history in my own family. And there's diaries and stuff. And so I read those. And I thought, wow, let's do that. And so it really became such a wonderful, adventure and imagination. And, you know, you could sit on a rock and look at a river and go, wow, you know, you just see the horses and the wagons going by. And it just, you know, it was such an amazing experience. So when I got back, I had written the 50 pages, and I gave it to her, and she said, oh, wow, you know how to do this. When can I have the whole book? And this was, I think, the beginning of November of that year. Can I have it by the first of the year? And, no, I mean, I'm supposed to write another 200 pages in 2 months. Give me till February. So I sat myself down, and every day I wrote and wrote and wrote, and I gave her the first draft in February, and she said, I'm going to represent this, but I want you to rewrite it. Okay, so she gave me notes, and for the next 9 months or so, I rewrote according to the notes that she had given me. And then she said, okay, it's ready. I'm going to shop it, you know, to a publisher and look for a publisher. Mm-hmm. Well, she found a publisher, and she sent it out to her top five, and one of them bit on it. And he loved it, and he said, okay, I'm gonna do it. We're going to do this book. I'm going to give you a two-book deal, but I want you to rewrite it. So he gave me notes, and I rewrote it. And it was quite an experience because a lot of personal things were going on at the same time. My stepfather was in the hospital, and while I was trying to deliver the book, I also was cast in a play in Santa Barbara where he lived. He and my mother lived up there. And it was a man for all. It was quite an experience because he went down in the hospital and never came out. I found out I was, it was The Lion in Winter, the play. The night I found out I was going to do the play, he passed away. And so had to go through all of this family, you know, everything, and finish the book and start rehearsal and bury my dad. Wow. Okay. That happened. It was beyond amazing, that whole period of time. But things, you know, they started to work out. We did the play. The whole family showed up. They were supposed to all be there for the final, you know, final performance. And we were missing one person, and that was my father, which was heartbreaking. And it was really difficult to get through the last scene of that play. But the book got published, and it was really quite wonderful because then the publishing company sent me on a trip, sent me on a book tour. And the book tour was all along the area I had already been to research the book. And I probably did, I don't know, maybe 60 or 70 schools. You'd go from one school to the next. Sometimes you'd be doing two or three schools, four schools in one day, relying on, you know, your phone to get you from one school to the other, you know, flying and renting cars, and you're hoping that you can make it in time, you know. And it was it was wonderful because it got to be such a relationship with these kids. And they were talking about mainly fourth, fifth, and sixth graders. So middle grade, and it was just a blast. You know, they were so warm and welcoming and appreciative, which made me feel good that I had done something, you know, that I did good, you know. And I got to have such a great time relating to all of these children and listening to them. And so that's how that whole experience went. And then they wanted another book. So I pitched a Revolutionary War story called The Secret Mission of William Tuck. And same kind of thing, only it took less time to put together. And then, you know, I did a whole, you know, book tour on the East Coast, different schools along from, you know, Virginia, Maryland. Wow, so that part of my life was a very new and creative life, and I'd already done decades as an actor in, you know, different shows and all across. So I'm still writing. I just finished another novel, a first draft, and, you know, I haven't turned it in yet because I'm still tweaking it. That one has three young heroes, two boys and a girl, different stories, rotating chapters, a little bit of time travel and historical fiction. So there we go.
Oh, cool. Sounds very cool.
It is cool. I think it's cool.
I like reading kids' books, and I don't care who says something against me for it. I love reading kids' books. So I'm sure that I would love it.
Well, you pick it up, and then they are not thin. You know, the first two books are 250, 300 pages, and they're fairly, you know, they're fairly complicated. They're kind of on the upper level of the between, say, middle and YA. I haven't attempted a YA book, and that's a whole different set of rules. I'm not sure I can handle it. You know, a lot of different ways to write a YA novel, and the gloves are off on a lot of things. But for some reason, I like the 10, 12-year-olds for book writing.
Yeah. Well, that's a good age for just about anything. Like they've even said in the movies, you have your best friends when you're 12, and it does seem to work out that way.
I want to tell you, I went to a reunion, and so many of my fondest memories are with my friends that age. When you're teenagers, it gets a little bit more complicated.
Right, exactly. Well, before we get into some of your acting credits, I just wanted to say one more thing. I mean, if you're done, if you wanted to say something else, by all means. But if you were done with what you were saying, I was just going to mention, and then you can say whatever you like about it, that you did win an award for The Last Ride of Caleb O'Toole.
Yeah,
so,
that is a highlight, one of the highlights of my creative life, is to go through this as a new author. And the award was, I knew that I was nominated. I was, I think on the short, you know, I think it got narrowed down to like five books, adult and five children. And I called my publisher and I said, is this a big deal? He says, yes, it's a very big deal. and then they were getting ready to announce it. It was from the Mountain and Plain Booksellers Independent Booksellers Association. And I started scrolling on the computer because the results were supposed to be in. And my book cover showed up as the winner. You should have heard. I scared my dog.
Aww.
Let out a yell of triumph and glee, and he's like, what the heck is going on? It's like 6:30 in the morning, you know? But it was such a vote of confidence, and it made me feel really just so good, you know? Just like, like if you were going to open a show and all the critics loved you, it's better than that, you know?
Aww.
I mean,
nice.
Yeah, because they got it, and Caleb will be out there for a while. William will be out there for a while, and this new one called Tagged, hopefully, will be coming around the bend within the next year.
Well, congratulations on winning your award, and I'm glad for you, and I'm glad that it's been such a great experience for you.
Well, I want to mention one other thing about books and kids before we switch to my acting life. I'm restarting what I call the Book Brigade. It's partnered with Kids Need to Read, and we deliver books to underserved kids around the country. So I'm going to promote that. It's a nonprofit fundraiser that I'm doing with them, and I just posted it on Facebook. So it's anybody who has a buck left. anybody has a buck left over from all of the asks during the political time for money. I know it's very really really difficult, but we're going to launch Book Brigade again, and maybe we can get books to kids because a lot of these underserved areas they don't get books and they don't have computers.
Right, and it's a very worthy cause. And if somebody is into politics, that would probably be a good thing to give their money to, at least a little bit. I mean, I know most people have a lot of money.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
If you buy one book, it'll get one book to one kid, you know. So you just try your best, you know.
And maybe one of those kids will grow up to be a senator or a president. You never know. So it will eventually may become political.
Well,
I'm just saying for those.
Yeah. Unless the part of the plot of the next book is where three kids not related to each other are going back in different points of time to take on a whole new reality, learn something, come back, so that then they seed the field of the future. So they learn by overcoming all these obstacles, completing the task, in order to help us now and become, you know, make a difference, right? So they're sort of an inspirational thing for each kid. They come back, and just by having done what they're doing, you take troubled kids and they're on track to not only have they learned something, but they're going forward with a different, different aspects of who they are.
Oh, interesting. Well, since we're already talking about that, and we will get to your acting, but there's no sense in jumping around. Now, if somebody wanted to, like, contribute to that, you know, the book brigade, what's the best way for them to do that?
They can find Kids Need to Read. They can go on a website. They can go on the Book Brigade website. There's a website called the Book Brigade. So they should be able to find that. And I can at least... I have a link. Where's my? I'm going to wander over to my computer here. Kids
and
Need to Read.
Have
is... Sorry.
Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Yeah. Okay. So Kids Need to Read has been around for a bit, I'm going to see if they've got. The site. Okay. They can go on mightycause.com.
Hmm. Okay.
And do you have your, can you see it on your computer?
I wasn't actually putting it up. So
oh, okay.
I will do that.
So.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm just putting it because I just now posted it, and people are already contributing. I posted it 20 minutes before you called, so...
Yeah, I saw your post. I thought you were talking about the mightycause.com, because I did just bring that up. But, yeah, I saw that post on Facebook that you posted not that long ago. So
yeah,
would it be on... Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm trying to crowdfunding. Boom, boom, boom. Yeah, they could probably find me on mightycause.com by surfing around. There's different, maybe I'll have to just get back to you on that.
Oh, that's okay, because, like you already gave some good ways. I mean, they could look up the book. The Book Brigade, and kids Need to Read, and I'm sure there will be something there. And there's also your website. Is there anything on your website that shows anything about that?
Yeah, there's. You can go on ericpierpoint.net, and you can find that.
Because I'm looking at it earlier, you know, because I do different types of research, and I was checking that out, and right now it's not letting me get to it for some reason. My computer's not working all that well. Well, it's because I'm trying to do too many things at once, I guess. Yeah, here it is. Yeah, it has author... by the way, people, we're talking about www.ericpierpoint.com, and you can I think you can buy some books from there, can't you?
Sure. Yeah,
I see here where, because there's Caleb O'Toole, The Secret Mission of William Tuck, where you can buy them. And I might as well look while I'm looking and tell the people how much they are, and since I'm already doing it. It depends on where you're getting it. The Kindle for Caleb is $7.99, and a paperback is $15.36. That's what's showing it anyway. So that's one thing that
Right now, I think what's happening is right now, let's see, I've got Denise here. I'm going to ask her real quick.
Okay. Well, it is a lot, Joe, so I'm trying to think of something to talk about while you're doing that. Because I don't see that on your website.
Yeah, it's not on there. I have to call my website manager and have that done. It looks like it's blank. It says it's not responding.
Yeah, so, well, you know what? Just let me put in thebookbrigade.com and we'll just, that'll only take me a second because I'm quick. I type real quick. And for some reason, this is telling me that it can be bought. It's not letting me get to it. Okay.
Well, you can buy my books on Amazon or a lot of different places, you know. So, yeah.
Well, so we'll just let that go for now.
Let it go for now. She may, by the end of our conversation, she may come up with, a general way that we can tell the public to do that.
Yeah, for now, we'll just let people know that they can always contact you on Facebook if they want to find out more information.
They can
I really want people to... I'm sorry.
Yeah,
go
there's
ahead.
There's two places to do it. They can find me on the Eric Pierpont Connection page on Facebook, or my own page on Facebook, and leave a message.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Because I really want to get the word out about that because it is a very important thing, and a few dollars here and there, hopefully people will be able to give some, and it's a very good cause. And I know it's very important to you, and it's the kind of thing that's important to me as well. So I want to make sure that people know. So hopefully she'll get back to you at the end of the show.
Okay.
So while waiting,
I have this.
I'm sorry.
Here's what
yeah, it's okay. Go ahead.
www.mightycause.com/story/bookbrigade. You know, I could send, you know, if I send you the, let's see, okay, so it's, yeah, www.mightycause.com/story/bookbrigade. She's got a bunch of different, you know.
Is it story or stories?
Story, period, one singular. So www.mightycause.com/story/bookbrigade.
Brigade. Okay. So that was the only thing I needed to put in after I found out whether it was story or stories.
Yeah.
And
so I'm going to now, and looks like people are already contributing. Wow. That was quick.
And this
people are.
Yeah. And this is, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, already I just posted it and there's several hundred dollars on there, you know, $1,600.
Oh.
Wow.
Oh, well, good.
Wonderful. That's just wonderful.
Good.
And it has, the thing is that it gives people a real, you know, description of what this whole cause is. And we started this a few years ago. I've done a couple of them. And there's photos. All this is nonprofit. Nobody makes any money off of this. It's just the kids get books.
Yeah, that's very, very cool. Okay, so now that we found that and let everybody know what it is, and we've told them about Facebook, now we'll get into your acting.
And if it's on the Eric Pierpont Connection, they can ask questions there, and I will dig into it and answer them. That's the yeah, kind of like the professional connection page.
Yes, yes, and that actually would be a very good place for them to contact you about anything, I think.
Sure. Yeah, ask questions, whatever. It's a matter of liking it, not necessarily friending.
Right. Okay, so is it okay for me to move on? Or
yeah, let's move on.
No? Okay. Well, I didn't want to, like, seem if I was rushing you or, you know, trying to make you talk about something you didn't want to talk about. excuse me. So you have like 87 acting credits. So even if we spent the whole show talking about just your acting credits, there would be no way that we'd talk about all of them anyway. So
just pick the highlights.
So I just picked some. I usually start with the first, or at least the first one on IMDb, which is not always the first one, but the first one on IMDb is 1984 for Windy City. So tell us about that one.
Okay, so Windy City, you remember The Big Chill, right? Windy City was sort of a little bit like that, in that it was a bunch of guys in their 30s who were trying to figure life out. And the way that happened, and it's kind of key, because in an actor's life, when you get a break, you have to turn one break into another break, you know, unless something is a gigantic hit right out of the chute. So I had been doing, I'd been doing a play in Washington, D.C., but I was living in New York, and I had done there was a national commercial that I had running, and a casting director from L.A. saw it, and they came to New York, and they were doing a casting session in New York, and so I got called to go up there, and I met with her. Her name was Diane Crittenden, and she said, well, I saw this commercial, and I thought, well, if he can do that, then I want him to read this movie. So I went up there. I flew up on my day off. I read for them. Armin Bernstein was the director, writer, and we had a great time. Sometimes as an actor, you feel like something really, really clicked and something was just okay and good, or you're trying to read the room, but you're not sure. So I left. I thought, I got to catch the plane, whatever. I don't know if this worked out. So I'm going to the elevator. The elevator door is closing as I'm inside, and the casting director's assistant came running up and stuck her hand there and said, would you mind reading a different part? Well, okay, I did. It was great. I felt much better about that. Then I went back and I did the play, and then they called again and said, can you come back up? I went back up. Can you read a different part? Yeah, okay, I can do that. All right, thank you. And so it went. I think they saw me four or five times. They ended up giving me a part I never read for. And I thought, it's like I always say, I think I just warmed down, you know? So it was originally titled All the Sad Young Men. Anyway, I got Windy City. We shot in Chicago for a couple of months, and it came out around 84. We actually shot it, I think, in 82. Well, right at that time, I'd been flying. When you land something, everybody gets curious, and then they want to see you. So they started flying me to test for all kinds of different projects, you know, television projects. So I was flying back and forth back in the day when they used to fly people to do this. They don't do that much anymore, I don't think. I eventually auditioned for a ton of stuff. I was living for 2 or 3 months at the Chateau Marmont in Washington, in L.A., which is a very famous kind of place where a lot of rockers go and, you know, whatever. And I was making the rounds. I almost landed a series. I had even auditioned for, you know, Miami Vice, and they had every actor, I think, in the United States auditioning for Don Johnson's role. So NBC really got to see me a lot. They put me into Hot Pursuit, which is one of the next ones on the IMDb thing. Hot Pursuit was really a ton of fun. Ken Johnson was a producer-writer, and so I got the pilot, and I became great friends with him, and it was a fugitive type of series with me and Kerry Keene. Dina Merrill was in it as like the evil, you know, woman, and we didn't make it past the first year. It was good. It's just that the ratings back then, if you didn't score big, you know, you didn't run for all that long. If you know, then midway is there's something called a pickup. Did you get picked up for the back, you know, back part of the season? So we were canceled, but I gained a foothold in L.A. So I went from there through different shows. I was on Hill Street Blues for a few shows. I always loved this one, playing Betty Thomas's love interest, and having to Betty Thomas is a tall woman, and I'm kind of in the middle. I'm about 5'10", and she's about 6'3" or something. And so when they had a side by side, sometimes I had to stand on like what they call a half apple box, so I could appear a little bit taller than her. So that was a lot of fun, and it's, you know, we go from one show to, you're like a gypsy. The next thing I know, the writer-producers from Hot Pursuit were Harry and Renee Longstreet. They went on Fame. They took over production of Fame. They created a part of a drama teacher, and they called me and said, we want you to do it. So for the last year of the last season of Fame, I became like the cool drama teacher. And that was a great fun because a bunch of really, really talented actors and actresses on that, you know, dancers, singers. And when they found out I wasn't a real good dancer, they did create a musical number for me. But they basically had me posing and pointing a lot. If anybody wants a good laugh, look up the number Look and Learn on YouTube, and you'll see what I'm talking about. You know, it's trying to be the cool drama teacher, but not really dancing. And I remember the dance captain saying, Eric, can you do this? Oh, can you do that? Well, just do this. Do that. It'd be like, you know, now I can ride a horse, but let's say you're an actor who can't ride a horse. They put the stuntman on the horse, but they put you on the horse and take a shot of you getting off the horse, okay? So that's kind of what it was like. Let's just fake this, you know? So it was – I faked it.
Yeah, that's actually one of the ones that I had, Fame – that I was going to ask you about, but you already went over it, so that's actually good.
Okay, yeah. It was a lot of fun, though, and it was. I knew it was just the last season, but it was a really fun show. A lot of great, fun young people.
Now, one that I want to talk about, for you know, you can just, like, make it short, because, you could talk about it as long as you want, actually. But Invaders from Mars, because I loved you in that movie. Well, I liked the movie itself, but I loved you. You were good in that movie. Well, I mean, you're always good, but I...
Well, we can make it short. Well, Tobe Hooper directed it. I had a good time with him. Karen Black was in it. I mean, really some fun people in it. It was a funky, you know, fun kind of a spoof. I never saw the original. A lot of people have seen the original, and they've said, oh, that was a scary movie. This one had a little bit of, as you would think, a sense of humor about it. But, yeah, it was a fun show to do. It was one of those things that just sort of happened, and Invaders from Mars, right. One of the interesting segues on that is that there was a military advisor for the show who was an actual colonel, I think. Dale Dye was his name. And during the course of it, he came up to me and he said, "You know, what do you think, Eric?" He was, you know, he was the expert who would make sure that we were soldiering enough, you know. He said, "There's this man, there's this director, Oliver, you know, Oliver Stone. He's doing this movie called Platoon. I'm not sure. He's asked me to kind of be in it and kind of advise and all that." And I went, "Well, you have to do it," you know. And so he was in it as an expert advisor, as well as in Platoon. Just kind of weird how things are interwoven like that, you know, and just a conversation about a movie that then becomes a major, a major hit and not, and a controversial show, I mean, movie. So that's, yeah.
Well, just to talk about Invaders from Mars for just a second, that because I've seen the original, I've actually seen it a couple of times because it's a pretty good movie, but it's like an old from like the 50s, I think.
Yeah, black and white.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is the one that you were in, it's not exactly the same, obviously, because it's more, you know, like what you said, spoofy, but it's not funny, but it's more spoofy. But it follows the original fairly closely.
Mm-hmm.
All the things that happen. So it's actually, that's what makes it interesting, because it does actually follow it pretty closely, even though it's kind of being spoofy.
Mm-hmm.
You might want to watch it sometime.
I'd like to. You know, I have it on a DVR. Invaders from Mars, and I watched it again. I hadn't seen it 20 or 30 years or something, and I think what happens with special effects, because you know, they're so different now than they were then. If you were to remake that movie now, it'd be another movie, a different, way different movie in terms of the visual aspects of it.
Right, and that's basically what it was. And the one that you were in, the Invaders from Mars, that's the main reason why it was different than the original, is because there was more special effects.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
There was a movie I remember, I can't remember, it was called, I don't know, It or something. And they never, during the entire movie, it was very, very scary. It was kind of like Alien in a way, where you never saw the alien that was trapped aboard the ship that came back from Mars and killed, you know, the crew one by one, and ended up suffocating in the atmosphere on Earth. And I remember seeing that when I was a kid. It was a black and white movie in the 50s, and I could hardly get through it. I was terrified. But you never saw, it was all about expectation, right? What you didn't see.
Right. Right. Well, I do want to make sure, not meaning to cut you off if you were going to say anything else.
Oh, no. Go ahead.
Okay. Because you can hardly have Eric Pierpoint on your show and not talk about, you know, a certain show. So I have to bring it up because the listeners will be expecting it. In 1989, you were part of a TV movie called Alien Nation. And then that brought about the TV series by the same name, of course. And it only lasted for one season for whatever reason. So there was like 21 episodes. And then after that, you did 5 TV movies of Alien Nation. So talk about it as long or as little as you want.
Sure. I think in every actor's career, you get a few projects that you cherish. You know, that's a show I cherish. Ken Johnson, who was Hot Pursuit, who was $6 Million Man, Bionic Woman, Incredible Hulk, V, and My Good Friend. He called me, and I had seen, it was actually, you know, the original James Caan, Mandy Patinkin feature, right? And I saw it, and I really liked it. And so Fox decided to turn it into a TV show. So they hired Ken, and he called me, and he said, Eric, I'm going to do a pilot. So the TV movie of Alienation you're talking about is the opening two-hour TV movie pilot. So he said, you got it. I want you to be in this, and we're going to be, you know, check it out. I said, well, let me look at the movie again. So I looked at it, and I thought I've told the story before that I thought he was interested in me doing, you know, the human role, the Sykes role of James Caan. Mm-hmm. No, I want you to do George. And then I thought, wow, let me look at, you know, so I looked at it again and I thought, oh God, yes, because there are infinite possibilities. And I had been trained, in, you know, all kinds of different genres and, you know, Shakespeare and British comedy and this and that. So I thought, well, I can invent something that I can use a lot of these tools, but also try to create a being that's, you know, very close to my heart, very special to me. And so when we got ready to do it, and Gary Graham and I were instructed, I got into makeup. Ken said, we want you to go down and mingle at the train station in L.A. You be in makeup, and Gary, you follow him around. And just get a sense of what it's like to walk around looking like that and observe how people observe you. And, of course, it being in L.A., a lot of people said, oh, Alienation, hey, the movie, I like the movie. You know, they like, okay, they think something's going on. Like, are they shooting another movie here? What's going on? But then you had other people's think, and I had one guy tell me he thought I was the ugliest person that had ever lived. When another guy, you know, started stabbing a milk carton when he saw me, a woman told her child, don't look at that man, he's a burn victim, you know. And it was fascinating because then you were kind of objectified in a way as a new member of society that looked different. And boy, I mean, what, I mean, Alienation brought up so many social issues and racial issues. And every, I mean, it was just amazing. But the writers were so good. And they, you know, we had fun every day. I mean, this was a show that, yes, my call time in the morning to get into makeup was 3:30 a.m. every day. And worked so hard because we had to shoot six scenes, let's say, so I had to memorize all this, you know, the scenes for the next day. I wouldn't get to bed until about 10 o'clock at night, and it just went over and over and over again. At some point, I lost all my eyebrows because of the glue in the makeup. And if you get a few eyebrows pulled out every day, you don't have any after a while. So
we had
a blast. We laughed constantly. I lost my mind a few times because it can feel a bit like you have this thing sucking on your head all day. It's not comfortable. Your hearing is very different because it's like you've got your hands over your ears. But it's interesting what happens, and I know all the Star Trek people will probably agree that if you're playing an alien, that makeup really influences what happens. So your insides and your outsides start to really, especially with George, it's not just going to be Eric with a head on, you know? So you start to develop a way of behaving, a way of walking, a way of talking, and he's from another planet, so how does he talk? Well, he's going to learn English in the right way. So what's the right way versus what is a contemporary way where, you know, you've got a Southern accent or you've got a New York accent or whatever. Doesn't make any sense. So it's more like someone trying to learn accent-free, or maybe it sounds a little mid-Atlantic or something. But the fun part of that is the invention. We were given so many, ceremonies to invent on the spot. A lot of the directors came in and they're thinking like, what are we going to do? You know, we got used to creating just on the fly. You know, if you have like a scenario where you learn through the script that, wait a minute, you're saying it takes two males to impregnate a female. Okay. So how do you do that? Well, this is the ganom and this is the binom, and first you got to go to one and then the other. And you go, who made this up, right? So, you know, and then by the way, Eric, you're the one that's going to deliver the baby. You're going to carry the baby. And you're going to run around with a gun at the same time. Uh-huh. And you're going to have, like, all of these. So one of the fun things is, of course, you've got to have all the discomfort of being pregnant, all the emotional ups and downs of being pregnant, and it's up to me to figure out how I want to do that. And, well, you know, observing women who talk about it, who are pregnant or whatever, and talk about their issues. So it becomes your issues. And there's only been a few actors who I think have, you know, given birth on television. I had a funny, just as a segue, I had a funny thing happen. I went in for a COVID test the other day, which mm-hmm. I found to be incredibly painful the first time I did it. Negative.
Yeah.
I thought they were doing brain surgery through my nose past my eyeball. That's what it felt like. Okay. So a few days ago, I go in again, and this young woman is there ready to give me the test. And I said, I have to tell you, I'm a complete wimp. I'm going to kick and cough and yell. I'm just warning you. And I know that some women have said, you know, come on, Eric, it's not that bad. I mean, we've given birth. And I just want you to know that as an actor and an alien, I have given birth too. Okay? And this is much more painful. So. But we had such good friendships that we still have from Alien Nation. It was so disappointing, of course, when it was canceled after the first season. We thought that was it. But Viewers for Quality Television, and a lot of fans kept writing in, and a couple people from Fox still loved it. So when they got the power back, they said, we got five movies. So when I got the call from Ken to do five movies, I was in heaven. So, and we could, you know, there's still so many issues you could cover in that show. But
right.
George will be one of my all-time favorite characters.
And that's the favorite character of a lot of your fans, because
I love
George.
Yeah, I love George, too. I mean, I would just give anything to go back and do it again.
Well, you know, the way things are, you never know. That might be one that they reboot. They seem to be rebooting everything else.
Yeah, you know, they reboot it, but they may have me back as a guest star because, you know, Matt and George might be in assisted living by then. You know,
yeah.
We're not getting any younger, right?
Well, when you say Matt and George, that's why I laugh, because,
yeah.
You know, Matt and George are not the same thing as the actors, so, yeah, they could be, like, really, really old. You know?
So we're trying to take care of ourselves. I saw Gary, you know, on a Zoom thing the other day. He looks great. I feel good. So we could get back there and still chase some bad guys, you know?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
I mean, look at Patrick Stewart and William Shatner and all these other people that well into their 70s, they were running around and having fights.
Just as a segue to Patrick Stewart, I really enjoyed working with him. That was a good experience.
And that's actually what I was going to segue into, since you had mentioned Star Trek. I know it was briefly, but you were talking about aliens. And just in the interest of saving time, and this is if you're done talking about Alien Nation, were you done talking about Alien Nation?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to lump them all together just in the interest of saving time, and then you can talk about each one individually, or you can just talk about the experience in general of Star Trek. But for the listeners, I'm going to go through each one. because you were on, you know, all of them, except for the original. Star Trek Next Generation, you did one episode. You did an episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. You did an episode of Star Trek Voyager. And you did 5 episodes of Star Trek Enterprise. So to make the Star Trek fans, which I'm one myself, talk about the Star Trek experience.
I will, yeah. When I was in college, we used to watch reruns of Star Trek, the original, on a little black and white TV that was about 10 inches wide. And I remember my college roommate saying to me, God, wouldn't it be great to be on a show like that someday? And ironically, years later.
Wow.
Well, yeah, I've told some of these stories before, some of the fans may remember, but when they were getting Next Generation together, they did bring me in to read me for the Riker role. Didn't get it, but they gave me a role that I thought was kind of cool, in that when I read the script, I go, wait a minute, how do I turn into a woman, right? Because
yeah.
They're not ready for the fact that I do not make an attractive woman, okay? You can put lipstick on me and a wig, and it ain't going to work. And then, of course, they hired Barbara Williams to play the me that turns into a woman. But it was that was a really enjoyable experience, because, you know, Patrick Stewart is such a, you know, really warm, talented gentleman, and such a, you know, such a good actor. And so I had fun on that. When I look back on Deep Space, because they also brought me in case, you know, they were trying to decide which way they were going to go for the captain role. So I was seen for that, didn't get it. But, you know, they gave me a captain role. Of course, I got my ship shot out from under me, but it was really kind of cool, because I hadn't seen it in a long time, but a British fan who told me that it was one of his favorite episodes in Captain Sanders. And I thought, God, that would have been fun, you know, to have a recurring role on Deep Space. That would have been a lot of fun. I enjoyed that. Of course, when you are doing Star Trek, playing a Klingon, I mean, everyone should get a chance to play a Klingon, I think. That was,
yeah.
You know, that was really kind of an interesting and deep role. Barge of the Dead, I think it was called. Getting into the Klingon makeup and getting into sort of the mental and vocal power of, you know, this character, Kortar. You know, that was a wonderful experience, too. I remember shooting. We had to shoot that last day. We shot for 24 hours because we were backed into the next episode, and we had to shoot that one out, so we had to keep going. And I was exhausted because I had done a convention back east. I think it was Shore Leave Convention. And I didn't get in. I was gone all weekend, and I'd shot Friday through Friday night, did Shore Leave, got on a plane, didn't get to L.A. until, I think it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. I didn't even have time to come home. I went straight to the set. And it took a few hours to get my Klingon self together. And then we had to shoot until, 2 o'clock the next day, next morning. And I was on my way home. And I got pulled over by the cops for weaving. And they gave me a drunk test. They said, have you been drinking? And I said, no, I've been a Klingon. And he laughed. He could see I had my script on the seat, but beside me. I still had that nasty black T-shirt with bits of makeup all over it. And, you know, he said, okay, follow my finger. Yeah, okay, all right. Can you find your way back to your planet? I go, yeah, okay. So he let me go.
Oh, that was nice.
Yeah, it was really nice. Yeah, exactly. Let's see. What else? Then where are we? Enterprise now?
Yeah, you just finished with Voyager, now we're on Enterprise.
Yeah, so Enterprise, Back to Voyager, there was a brief moment when I guess the original Kate Milgram's character was Genevieve Bugeaud, the original, for 5 minutes. I guess they were still trying to decide what they were going to do after that happened, and I think there was a brief moment where they were considering, do we go female, male, or whatever, and I have a memory of going down to read for that role, but then Kate got it, and so then doing that, I just saw recently the what the heck was the name of it? Do you have the episode in front of you? The episode of The Dark Planet or something?
On which show?
On Enterprise. Mm-hmm. I mean. It was one of three aliens hunting intelligent game on a dark planet. I forgot the name of the episode. It doesn't really matter. But we are hunting intelligent game. And then they had me come back again to read for a Klingon role a couple years later. And I read it, and then they looked at me and they said, wait a minute. Eric, would you mind just taking the script and these sides, the scene, and going out and looking at it? There's a role of an agent. Not an alien. Would you come back in a few minutes and just give it a shot? And I went, yes. And they gave me Harris. And that was different, you know. It was like, that's kind of cool, the whole concept of it. And doing, I think, 4 or 5 episodes as Harris. I enjoyed that a lot, too. That Star Trek experience, I mean, it's a... all actors should be doing a Star Trek, I think, you know, somewhere down the line.
Yeah.
I'm
sorry, go ahead.
No, it doesn't matter. Go ahead.
All I was going to say was I didn't realize you were talking because there was a little bit of overlap. Is that overlap. I think the one that you were talking about was Rogue Planet.
Right. I think... I kind of think somehow that was an idea that had been explored in the 60s. I don't know if it was Twilight Zone or something, but anyway. So Star Trek, I never landed the role that made me go to work at 2 o'clock every morning every day. You know, the captain role or something, which except for Sanders... I would have loved to have seen, say, a recurring role as far as that goes. That would have been a lot of fun to do.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. But with the Star Trek universe, one thing that's great about it, and there are many, 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 literally thousands that can tell you, you only need to do one episode, and you are forever in the Star Trek family.
So true,
and
yeah.
And you'll get... Yeah, you can even, you know, make money off of that one episode that you did just by signing autographs or what.
Oh, yeah,
you.
That's classic. Yeah. It's it reminds me of, and there are guest actors who have only done one episode who sell autographs, and what's the the spoof in the beginning of Galaxy Quest? You know that show, right?
Yeah.
Where, can I slip in there? I was like, you know, I was killed by the Loch Monster in one episode, but, you know, can I just, like, sign here?
Yeah.
I love it. Galaxy Quest is, like, such a guilty pleasure for me.
Yeah.
Because here I am. I've studied classically. I wore the makeup and Alan Rickman. And I go, God, I feel for you, man, because, you know, Gary Graham, and it was such a parallel. Gary Graham would come in, shake his hair, he'd be ready on set. Poor Alan Rickman, or me, we'd be stuck in makeup, and we're going, and like, you know, we're not getting the respect, you know. Gary and I would laugh because we'd be walking through an airport and people would recognize him but not me. And he'd have to introduce me to the fans that went up to him. This is while we were doing Alien Nation. And say, okay, guys, hang on. This is George. George! You know? So thank you, Gary. Thank you for letting them know. Appreciate it.
Aww.
Oh, God.
Yeah,
and
go ahead.
No, I was just the image of Alan Rickman's, you know, makeup and prosthetics, you know, curling up toward the end of the movie as the glue is, as it's just kind of like all fouled up and everything. I don't know. It's just funny to me when I think about it.
Yeah, well, that movie was pretty funny. I want to backtrack a little bit because I did want to ask you about this one. You don't have to talk about it for very long, but it's like one of my favorite movies. Well, for one thing, I like Mel Gibson, you know. And in 1992, you were in Forever Young. Of course,
yes.
You didn't play a very nice person, but
no.
So go ahead and talk about that.
Sure. Well, Forever Young, they told me, they said, we want you to play a, you know, I read for it. They said, can you do a stunt? I said, yes, I've always done my own stunts, a lot of them, you know. I've galloped horses, I've jumped off of trains, onto trains, I've done this or I've done that. Well, we're going to get, it's not a big role, but it's a fun role. We want to put you into kind of like a badass character. And you have a fight with Mel. You jump on, you basically assault Jamie Lee Curtis and you fight Mel. And I said, okay, all right, I'm on board. When do you need me? And they said, well, you know, a couple months. And I went, all right, I'm going to get myself in real good shape. So I hired a trainer and everything. But the last thing they said before on set, you wouldn't hit Mel, will you? You know, you wouldn't hit him. Like, you mean like by accident? No, I think I can handle it. So it was, I liked the movie a lot. And we got to the scene. We shot it over a period of a couple of days, a few days, I guess. And just this kind of surly, not likable, you know, character. And how Jamie Lee, her character actually went out on a date with him, I'll never know. Because he didn't look like the guy that you would really want to date, you know, past maybe one drunken evening, you know. So I remember going in, and Jamie Lee was really game. She wanted to be really roughed up, you know, so she could carry that sensation into the next scene. Oh, there's my dog. Into the next scene. This is Cola, my dog. And there is a...
Hi, Cola.
There's a guy walking his lab by the house, and she doesn't like that dog. She's announcing, just get out of, you know, get away from my property. That same guy, the same lab, bark at each other. Okay. All right, so I had to jump on Jamie Lee over and over again. Well, Mel then runs in and throws me off of her, and then we stare each other down, and then we start the fight. So it's basically a rough and tumble stunt fight. And a lot of fun. He was the kind of a guy back then, I remember him, you just sort of sit and have a beer with, you know? Really nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'd always admired his work. You know, whatever happened later or whatever, it doesn't matter to me, because back then, he was a gentleman, very respectful and very kind of into what he was doing. And he had a huge responsibility and a huge role. And here I am, you know, just there for 3 days. And so we did the fight in different angles and we're making stuff up and, you know, I had a pretty good case of whiplash because they had him constantly hitting me, but I could never hit him, never touch him. you know, because he's the hero. And he knew how to fight, and apparently I didn't. So at one point, you know, I'm snapping my head and snapping my head and snapping my head, and my neck's getting more and more sore, and the head stunt guy there, stunt coordinator, was like, "How you doing, Eric? How's your head? How's your neck?" Okay. He did hit me with a jab on the forehead and was horrified. I went, "No, I'm fine." And then it came time for the big punch. He throws a haymaker. I fly back. My head hits a solid oak lamp, okay, hard enough so that the bulb broke, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this lump is showing up on my head, and the director says, "That was great. Can you do it again?" Corner says, "No, he's not going to hit the lamp with his head again." That's crazy. So they sent me packing, and that was it. So, you know, like the kick dog I was, I exited very humbly out the door. But, you know, I enjoyed working with him. I enjoyed a lot working with Jamie Lee Curtis, too.
No, well, I'm glad you had fun doing that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, some of these larger-than-life situations, actors, like Liar Liar, for example, with Jim Carrey. Again, it was like a nice little supporting role in probably what I always thought was his best movie. It took forever to shoot the courtroom scene in there. And he had everyone, Jim Carrey had everyone laughing, you know, from morning to night. I mean, he came up with so many different things. It was so, he was hysterical. And so when I watch it, I just watch his antics, and I think I wasn't going to do that movie because I was in the middle of moving from one house to another house. But I got talked into doing it, and I'm glad I did because it, you know, it's a classic for him.
Yeah, it is. And it was a good movie.
Yeah.
And you're part of what made it good. So there you go.
Well, every actor has a part, right? You know, you could be starring in something, or you're just going to, you know, put in whatever you can.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I actually, I'm sure you've noticed this, but we actually went longer than an hour because I kind of knew we were going to be longer than an hour, so I scheduled for an hour and a half.
Oh, fine.
So
you're fine.
So of the hour and a half, we have like about 10 minutes left. So,
well, you know, actors and talking about themselves never happens, right? So we don't like talking about ourselves.
No, not at all. Well, actually, there are a few that don't. I had a guest on my show, and I even joked with somebody else. It was a really good friend that, you know, knew him because he was the one that suggested him to me and asked, had me ask him if he wanted to be on the show, and he said, yeah. And then when I had him on the show, getting him to talk was like trying to go outside and dig up a 6-foot pole that was put in the ground. I mean,
that's
why
rough.
Did you say you wanted to be? Yeah. Why did
that's
you
like
say
the
you
actor's
wanted to be on
the show? When you go on stage and you don't know what play you're doing, you know, like you're interviewing and you can't get anything out of your person.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure you figured it out. My show is really laid back. It's like, you know, we don't even have to talk about your movies if that's not what you want to talk about. And that's why I'll ask people, is there anything specific you want to go over? Because some people do that. They don't want to talk that much about their film work, but they want to talk about other stuff. And then some people, I know the kind of stuff that they're into, you know, like your book brigade and going across the country with the kids. And so I make sure I work that in because it's important to you and to the fans and to me as the host. It's important to me. So I try to work that all in. One guest I had, she was very into the environment, so I made sure that I worked that in, so she got to talk about the environment. But with this guy, it's like he wouldn't tell me anything that he wanted to talk about, and he had only done like three things as far as movies go. And when I asked the guy who suggested it to me, he couldn't tell me anything about it. I was like, okay, how am I supposed to stretch that into an hour? But this just shows you how good I am. And really, you know, sorry for tooting my own horn, but, he's gone. So I didn't even know that. I just kept talking. Okay, that's embarrassing. Okay, if you can hear me, Eric, I'm sorry about that. And, you know, let me try to call him back, and then I can at least say goodbye properly, because that was actually kind of embarrassing. Okay, people, sorry about that. I'm not even sure how long that he wasn't there. I just now noticed it.
Hi.
Hi.
Just the battery. The phone died.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. Yeah, I was in the middle of talking, and I'm like, just blah, blah, blah. I'm just talking, yak, yak, yak. And then I noticed you're not there anymore. So for me, it was embarrassing.
I bet it was. Well, you know, we just wore the phone out. But go ahead.
But the reason why I called you back, normally, like if it was like near the end of the show, well, actually, which it is, it's near the end of the show. But, I mean, if we had already gone over everything and we were basically done anyway, I probably would just say, well, you know, we'll let that go. But, like, you know, you
well,
might have had something else.
It's okay. We're here.
Because I wanted to say goodbye properly, you know.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah. So there's only like 8 minutes left anyway. So you had already, and it's not like we have to go the entire 8 minutes or anything like that. But I did want to ask you if like, do you have anything, you know, other than the book that you already talked about, you're tagged. Do you have anything new coming out as far as movies or anything else that you're doing that's in the works?
Well, right now it's really difficult because no one's working, you know.
Right, with COVID, yes.
Yeah, everything is kind of shut down. It's tough, you know. They're trying to figure out how to restart this whole thing. And I've had like one meeting in 6 months. And that was a couple of weeks ago. What they do a lot now is you'll do these meetings from home. You might record your own, you know, video your own audition and then email it in. That happens. I do a lot of ads around the country for law firms. I still do those, and that I'm able to actually accomplish from my own house. But as far as dramatic television or film, people are, you know, starting to work here and there, but it's really, we've never seen anything like this, you know.
Right.
So we're hoping, you know, just hoping that things open up again. Yeah. And safely. They have to figure it out with the crew and hair, makeup, lighting, sound, how to be safe, you know. So it's tough.
Well, yeah, my independent filmmaker friends, they've been making films, but, you know, it's hard for them as well because, yeah, it's not like they have to go through quite as much as, you know, Hollywood does, but they still have to make sure that they follow the guidelines, and then they do a lot of remote work, but you can't do everything remotely. And then when you do have to have people in the same basic area, anybody that's not on camera has to make sure that they have their mask on. So it is like a pain in the butt. So I understand what you're saying. And so many of them.
Yeah, it's hard. My sister lives in Montana, and she runs a humane society up there. So part of my acting world was they're big Parks and Recreation fans up there. And so she was doing a fundraiser, and she wanted me to kind of MC the fundraiser in character from Parks and Recreation as police chief. So she sent me photos of 12 or 15 homemade benches that they were going to auction off, and she wanted me to say funny stuff about each one and video them. So I worked for like several days, and this was my own film production company, filming myself in character as Chief Trumple from Parks and Recreation, and they made a lot of money. So it was kind of successful. Otherwise, my acting partner right now is my dog, making, you know, funny videos with her. I mean, what's an actor to do, you know? I mean, we got no audience. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, everybody's going through stuff, you know. We just have to get through this, you know.
Right. Yeah, so many people are having trouble. And I keep reminding people it's not just the quote-unquote little guy. You know, the people in Hollywood are having trouble, too.
Everyone.
Yeah, it's bad for everybody. It's not just the little guy, although it's worse on the little guy.
Sure it is.
Because I understand that being one of those little guys, although I'm not the farthest down. Because luckily I'm
killing everybody, and it trickles down and it makes it worse. And you know, you've got to keep people working if you can. You know, if you have a gardener,
yeah,
or if you have a housekeeper, whatever, I've managed to keep things going that way, and because they have families, they have to pay rent. You know, it's really, really hard, and just try to support
exactly where
you can. And so we're doing the best that we can, and we just have to figure out how to get ourselves out of this somehow. So, you know, I know you don't want to talk politics, and that's good, but.
There's a difference between political and politics.
Yeah.
So what we're doing is like it's just a little bit political. It's not really politics, because that's when you start talking about the candidates and all that. I don't want to talk about that. No.
No.
But but with what's going on, I mean, what I do, because I'm disabled, and I've reminded people that this is one of the things you can do. If you don't, or if you want to go out to a restaurant, but I don't want to go into the restaurant, have it delivered, and
sure,
let those people make money that way. And so that's what I have a housemate, and her and sometimes her boyfriend will want to get stuff, and so we'll all pool it together and we'll order from a restaurant, and sometimes she and I will order our groceries and have them delivered. And so these delivery people are making money.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I agree. I do that when I can. And it's if you can afford to go out there and try to keep supporting, you know, the life around you and the people around you. I live in a really nice rural area here in Topanga, California, and it's in the hills, and wonderful neighbors, and we're always walking around with dogs, and they're walking their kids and whatever, and we have these conversations, and everybody feels, you know, pretty much the same way, trying to do the best they can,
right,
trying to, you know, keep going. A lot of people have learned how to work from home.
Right.
And and are actually, you know, some, I actually ran into a couple of people who said, you know what, I just shut down they dismantled their office, and their office is now in their home. And he goes, you know what, I don't have to pay rent now, so I'm just going to work from home. You know, so we're trying to adjust, and the thing is, you know, you don't know how long it's going to last, so you have to keep,
right,
well, you really have to keep yourself positive somehow.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, you have to somehow. Now we are getting down to the last 30 seconds. So Now, you already told everybody about your website and the best way to get a hold of you and everything, which is usually what I ask at the end of the show. So we've already done that. So just, is there anything else that you want to say in closing?
No, I enjoyed the conversation a lot, and I just appreciate the fans over the years who have supported us. I mean, not just me, of course, but supported our business, and that just want them to know that how much I appreciate my own steps along the way in my career and people's interests. It makes you feel really good when people enjoy what you do. You know, it's a really it's a nice feeling. So thank you all of you guys out there.
Oh, well, that's very sweet. Okay, Eric Pierpoint, it was a pleasure having you on the show, and maybe sometime in the future you'll want to come back. And thank you very much, and stay safe and have a good night.
You too, Mac. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.